from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Back in the 1950s, a thin book of poetry sparked a police raid of a San Francisco bookstore and a landmark court trial over selling obscene, as it was called, material. And that book was Howl and Other Poems by Allen Ginsberg. It put City Lights Publishers, now known as City Lights Publishing House, City Lights, period, on the map. And same for its owner, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. That is a literary map. And this year, City Lights Publisher is celebrating its 60th anniversary. We want to look back in this Forum half hour on its storied history and on its current place in the publishing world. And I ought to mention that a couple of books have come out from City Lights Publishers. One is a selected correspondence between Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Allen Ginsberg, and the other is a collection of volume of poetry that includes many of the beat poets and poets who might surprise you being included. Like, did you know that Pablo Picasso had written poetry? And with us in studio to talk about, well, the history and to talk about really the whole extraordinary history of City Lights is Elaine Katzenberger. She's a publisher and executive director of City Lights Books, and she's here, and welcome.
Thank you. It's great to
have you with us. Great to have you here. Where to begin? Let's begin by talking about Howl, because a lot of this whole adventure really begins with Howl, doesn't it?
Well, I mean,
The store was there before that, but I mean, in terms of the beat movement and the getting on what I call the literary map. And
right. I mean, you know, and Lawrence always likes to say, which I think is the truth, that the beat movement wouldn't have existed without Allen Ginsberg, because he basically created it out of whole cloth. He was a really adept at publicity and at naming and at including people into under certain rubrics. So that was actually created by Allen as an umbrella. But his poem, Howl, obviously, that Howl trial and Lawrence's defense of the right to publish that book and the landmark legal precedents that were set by that trial definitely put City Lights on the map in a way that City Lights was thriving as a bookstore already. It was very small. It was 1953, and then Howl was published in 55.
When did you go? You were working $6 an hour as a bartender, I think. Weren't you? And then some guy named Berman came in, Richard Berman.
That's true. I was working at Vesuvio when I first moved to the city back in 1980. In 81, I got a job opening the bar at Vesuvio at 6 in the morning. And Richard Berman, who was the manager of the bookstore, used to come over and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes, and we'd talk about books, and we got to know each other. And 6 years later, when I returned to San Francisco after a small stint in New York, he offered me a job at the bookstore, and I was pretty done with bartending at that point in my life. And so I took that job, and the rest is history. It's been 28 years.
Well, the rest is history also for the beat movement. I didn't want to put all of it on Allen Ginsberg. In fact, what some people forget is when Allen Ginsberg gave that reading, Gary Snyder was there, that original reading of Howl, and so were other poets. But the fact of the matter is that it changed America and continues to have reverberations in terms of those changes vis-a-vis the beat movement and all that went with it. And this, as a publisher, I mean, first of all, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, we should mention, was the first poet laureate in 1994. And as a publisher, first poet laureate of San Francisco, I should say, he's, in addition, many people may know this, a painter, has had a novel that's been underway now. He's 96. And how long has he been working on this novel?
You know, I'm not sure exactly. I think on and off for a number of years, actually. He's published a couple other novels years ago. He's mostly known as a poet, and he's a wonderful poet.
And also was a Navy lieutenant commander and was in Normandy. I mean, there are many things about his biography that are fascinating. But I mention all that largely because he became a major figure. It wasn't only Ginsberg. I mean, people wanted to go to City Lights Bookstore almost as a kind of pilgrimage, you know, like going to Graceland for Elvis or something, and still do. Mm-hmm. I mean, you read about the history and you read about Howl coming there and you read about, you know, all these major figures who had to go to City Lights.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lawrence, I mean, you know, Lawrence is a very beloved poet, and he's internationally well-known and loved. And Coney Island of the Mind, his second book, his first book he actually published at City Lights. It's how the publishing company began. It's the 60th anniversary of that book as well, Pictures of the Gone World. Coney Island of the Mind was published a year later by New Directions, and that book, last time I checked, was actually the best-selling poetry book in the United States. So that's really saying something.
A book that, as a young man, had an enormous influence on
yes.
me. Made
yes.
me want to be a poet, which I yeah. failed at. But, I mean, let's talk about the bookstore, though, because many of the people there, Paul Yamazato and you, to some Stacey Lewis, thinking about Nancy Peters, who unfortunately couldn't be with us today. We wanted to have her here. Been long-serving
yes. Yeah, that's true.
And I mean,
and that says a lot, you know, when people stay in an institution and do their work there for that many years, it tells you something about how nutritive and rewarding it is to be part of a project like that. You know, I've been there for 28 years, and Paul Yamazaki has been there for close to 45, I think it is now, and Nancy was there for, I think, about 40, and Lawrence, of course, is still doing it after at 60 years and counting.
We have a clip, I think, from Paul. Let's hear it.
From its initial moments, that it wasn't just a bookstore. It was a powerful, powerful symbol of and desire for people to be able to get together, to share ideas, and to have a common space to be able to do that. The way that Lawrence says it, it's like once we opened the doors, we couldn't get them shut. You know, and that seems to have been the case ever since. I came to City Lights in 1970. For part of the culture at that time, books were important. You were kind of identified by your peers by what books you had in your back pocket or in your bag. You know, I've been working here now for over 40 years. I come to work every day kind of very, very enthusiastic, happy, wanting to get my hands into it. So I'm here forever, or boots up, whatever comes first.
That's Paul Yamazato, known certainly from City Lights fanciers and people who know the bookstore and people who've dealt with it. And that's from the Exploratorium video series. And as I said earlier, we got a couple of books out. And Elaine, I want to talk about them with you, this anthology. I gave a little tease there when I said a poem by Picasso. But you expect a City Lights anthology to have the Beat Poets, and it does. It has Gregory Corso, who I discovered was a thief. I didn't know that whole story in reading the letters between he actually stole money from the bookstores. But anyway, you got Kenneth Patchen and Ginsberg and, of course, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Kerouac, Bob Kaufman, Jack Hirschman, and so forth. But some names that may surprise you, like Pablo Neruda and Yevtushenko and Malcolm Lowry. How do they fit into this schema?
Well, you know, Lawrence, this was Lawrence's signature series, and he has been the editor of this series all the way through. And so it really is a reflection of his taste and curiosity and intention. And he's always said that from the beginning, the goal was to not be provincial and to be international in scope. And so he's always been interested in translations and in kind of an eclectic approach to what is poetry. I mean, as I understand it, it's hard to look at this and really understand what's behind the selections, but in Lawrence's mind, each one of these poets represents something revolutionary. And that may be straight up politics, but it's often style or ideas. So all of those things are part of the rubric of selecting what's in the Pocket Poets anthology.
Makes it sound like Lawrence was the major selector here, so to speak.
Oh, yes, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, others, I have contributed to it and others have too, but Lawrence is really, it's his imprimatur on there.
And the other book that's just come out in conjunction with this anniversary that you're celebrating are the letters, which Lawrence Ferlinghetti never expected would be published.
No, well, usually you don't think that's going to be true. Nowadays, we know that everything is out there, but back in the old days, I don't think he was thinking that they would see the light of day.
Well, in fact, he says some very interesting things about those letters. In fact, he says, Allen Ginsberg never said a word about my poetry and the aftermath of that, which kind of struck a chord with me. Why, I wonder, did Allen Ginsberg never say a word? And was he maybe sort of hurt by that?
Well, I think a little, but it's not exactly true, because if you read the book, there is back and forth. Of course, Lawrence is talking about Allen's poetry all the time because he's his editor and publisher, and he's editing his poetry and commenting on it and improving it and helping. So the relationship would not have worked that way in the reverse. And I think that but you can see in the letters that there are times where Allen is actually offering Lawrence criticism or praise. But I think that, you know, Lawrence felt that, and I think it was true, Allen had an inner circle of people and that didn't include Lawrence. Lawrence was of a different sort of generation, actually.
He said, I'm heterosexual at one point. He distinguished himself from Allen.
He was older, and he was not writing in the style of the Beats. He didn't consider himself a Beat. So I think that that's partially what happened there. But also it's the nature of their relationship because, as I say, Lawrence was Allen's editor and publisher, and therefore he was the one shepherding Allen's work, and it didn't work in the other direction.
We're talking Elaine Katzenberger, who is publisher and executive director of City Lights Books, and these two books are now out and certainly available. The collection of letters is called greets you at the beginning of a great career and follows letters from 1955 to 1997, excuse me, and is edited by Bill Morgan. This is, again, part of the celebration that we're talking about. When Allen Ginsberg died, we had a program. It was very memorable on Ginsberg. We had Paul Krasner. We had Peter Coyote. I remember it very well. Ken Kesey, Diane Middlebrook, and Mark Linenthal. How's that for a quintet? Mm-hmm. And Lawrence sent over that poem that he did, yeah. Which is really, and you can hear it on video. I think we'd like to get it posted on our website if we can, where he's reading the poem about Allen Ginsberg dying. It's all about the conversations on the telephone that they had. And what struck me about the letters is once they started making cheaper international calls, the letters kind of diminished between the two of them.
It's true. As technology marched on, that replaced letters, and we're all in that boat now. I mean, when's the last time you received a printed letter in the mail?
In fact, that's a good segue. I wanted to get to this. When I think the last time I interviewed Lawrence Ferlinghetti was during the last boom, and he had some things to say about technology, about the techies, and here's a clip from an interview with him earlier this year. He's talking about the dot-com boom.
A new brand of millionaire, dot-com millionaires, have moved into San Francisco with bags full of cash and no manners. The dot-com culture seems to have no interest in the high culture of this country that once existed.
Well, now you could say that's, you know, curmudgeon, he's 96, nonagenarian, he feels that way about. But at the same time, things have changed so enormously, first in the Mission, and he remarked on that, and now in North Beach. So he's witnessing it, and he's not very happy about it.
I don't think he's the only one.
I don't mean to suggest that he is the only one, rest assured. But Manhattanization was what he was talking about back then, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's not just more people and more buildings. It's also a sensibility. And I think that when Lawrence came to San Francisco and when I came to San Francisco, and maybe when you came and plenty of us, we came for a set of reasons, and they weren't about making money. So to live in a boomtown is a different thing, and that's what we live in now. And these people who are flooding the city, they're just workers. You know, they're people who need jobs and are doing what they're doing. But the city is being transformed, and everyone's highly aware of it. And when you see all of the kind of intellectual and artistic capital of the city in the, moving and having to move out and being forced out, and really all that's happening here is that people are here to make a killing, that's quite a different place.
It's also against, in many respects, what, going back to Howe, what that poem was all about. It was anti-materialism, Moloch, you know, right. And all the taking over of what we're seeing is forces of money as an end in itself and profit in itself and everything. And I think that's the sort of thing that the Beat Movement was reacting against. Actually, speaking of the Beat Movement, I thought we'd just hear, for the sake of old times or whatever, because of the influence that the Beat Movement has had and continues to have, here's a clip of Jack Kerouac reading from On the Road.
Out we jumped in the warm, mad night, hearing a wild tenor man's bawling horn across the way going, ee-yah, ee-yah, and hands clapping to the beat, and folks yelling, go, go, go. And far from escorting the girls into the place, Dean Moriarty was already racing across the street with his huge bandaged thumb in the air yelling, blow, man, blow.
There it is. Not necessarily more a voice that one hears in prose in one's head than one necessarily hears, as we just heard. That was Jack Kerouac reading from his own work. And the thing that has to be said about the Beat Movement was it was highly political, much more than I suppose most people realize. And in fact, just had City Lights started with those banners. Let's talk a bit about that just for the history's sake of things. I think the first banner was a quote of James Baldwin to Angela Davis.
That's right. This was back, actually, speaking of the dot-com boom, that was during that period, and there was a proposition, I believe it was Prop L, that had to do with development and eviction at that time. And
fighting gentrification, maybe.
Indeed. So our banner series started kind of informally with that. There was a group called the San Francisco Print Collective that was active in the Mission, and they did wheat pasting of posters and used sort of artistic means to try to call attention to what was going on. And they called and asked for a donation, and I said, well, why don't we use the front of the building as a platform for you? And so there was a banner with a picture of a tractor demolishing a house, and it said, if they come for you this morning, they'll be coming for me tonight. And that's a letter that James Baldwin wrote to Angela Davis. After that, we did an intentional collaboration with them, and the next series, then we started to do much more formalized banners. And the next ones were put up right after 9/11. And so at that time in San Francisco, there were a lot of flags around, and there was a general sense that even in San Francisco, you had to watch what you say. And that was certainly the rhetoric coming out of the White House at that time. It was we had just been designated a literary landmark, and we had a celebration in front of the bookstore where the street was closed off, and we had a panel of readers, and we timed it so that the banners would be premiered that day. And it was a series of five faces with flags sewn over their mouths, and the text of the banner said, "Dissent is not un-American." And those banners stayed up for quite a while, and we got a lot of feedback about that. And we had people coming in and telling us, you know, that they lived in parts of the country where they felt afraid to speak, and that this gave them hope and made them happy. And it was really inspiring and powerful for us as well.
Lynn Katzenberger with us in studio, publisher and executive director of City Lights Books. And lots of memories about City Lights Bookstore, and perhaps questions and comments from you, our listeners. So let me indeed invite you to join this program. We invite your calls. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us at that phone number, 866-733-6786. And there are a number of other ways of joining us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Just to give you a flavor of some of the responses that we're hearing from listeners, a listener writes, "I am so grateful that the founders of City Lights arrived on the scene in an era when ideas existed within an intellectual discourse instead of an online thread." David writes, "City Lights was my first stop when I hitchhiked out here from Wisconsin back in 1974. Bravo for being the stalwart in this new age of online everything. Is City Lights Publishers still thriving, and how are they staying vital, and how might a struggling new age poet today get a manuscript to them?"
I knew there would be one of those questions.
No, they're always good, yeah.
I think that's beautiful to hear those comments, and that touches on something that Paul said in that clip that you broadcast, and I want to emphasize as well that it's true that in an age where much happens in a disembodied world, a place to go where you actually interact with ideas and other people who are interested in ideas, that's what a bookstore is, and that's what City Lights is. And in a way, City Lights has always been a safe zone for beyond just ideas. It's also perhaps marginalized ideas or marginalized voices and things that you otherwise might not hear or see. And it's, I think,
and
that it's,
we're hearing and seeing less of as time progresses.
Exactly.
Can you get a manuscript to you?
Submission guidelines are on our website.
Easy enough. Give that out, the website.
Yeah.
Citylights.com.
Yeah.
Here's Mark, who writes, "For many years and even today, my feeling was that when standing in City Lights Bookstore, I was standing in the spiritual and literal heart of San Francisco. This is all the more reason that Mr. Ferlinghetti's recent video piece on KQED reads to me like a eulogy for the city I have long loved and which has become almost unrecognizable." All right, we don't want to get too mordant here. I remember that poem in City in Coney Island of mine, "The Smiling Mortician" shows
right.
up. Yeah, that
right.
came to mind. Let me get the callers on, though. And the first caller, Diamond Dave, you're on.
No, I remember the first time when I first hitchhiked in 1957, and in response to Kenneth Drexler's article, "Nation, that something is happening in San Francisco," and I wanted to be part of it, and I stood in front of City Lights, and there was this kind of young bearded guy putting in copies of Howl in the window, much smaller City Lights then, and so I walked in, and it turned out it was Lawrence Ferlinghetti putting back copies of Howl after Behe and Shig were put in the trial, and that was his. That was a very perfect moment to begin this adventure I call my life, 1957, at Salice Bookstore. And there I was, and here I still am, many years down the line.
Well, it's good to hear from you, Dave. We haven't heard from you in a while. I'm glad you called. Diamond Dave, otherwise known as Dave Whitaker, was part of that whole beat movement and actually a kind of mentor to Bob Dylan. And become an institution in San Francisco. People recognize his voice everywhere because he used to call in for him on a regular basis. Good luck. Good to hear from you. Now we hear from Karen Finley, who's calling us from New York. And I don't even know if you remember, Karen Finley, when I interviewed you and you said, I feel like you're in the power position. And I said, OK, come over here. And we switched places. That's only happened one time in my broadcast career.
I do remember that. And it's so wonderful to I am an author with City Lights, and I am so indebted to City Lights for publishing my work, The Shock Treatment. In 1990, as you remember, during the culture wars and...
during Karen Finley's wars with Jesse Helms. I remember them well.
Well, it even went to with the U.S. government, and I was the named plaintiff for a case that went to the Supreme Court about public funding and the arts, and City Lights published many of those texts in my book that were considered to be indecent.
So you feel, from the sounds of it, a real debt to City Lights books?
Yes, they were, just for for so many reasons, the history, their belief in for the writer's voice, and their history of standing up to censorship, and always being provocative writing, experimental writing, and putting the writer and the writing first, and that gave me the support, besides just on a professional level, but the knowledge and the history of City Lights and what their contributions to the world really gave me so much support emotionally for me to withstand the 8-year trial and exposure that I had to go through and endure, knowing the history of what City Lights has been through.
It's also ironic to think about how much controversy was stirred by the work that you did, especially in light of what we see on today's horizons. A lot of people might be interested in hearing, what are you doing now, Karen Finley? Where is life taking you?
There is going to be an anniversary edition of Shock Treatment that will be out, and I will be on tour for that. And I am performing and writing, and I'm touring to doing a 14-city tour with Shock Treatment, and performing abroad. And I'm also a professor at NYU in art and public policy. So I try to teach others, young people, about creating controversial or creating art that can influence society and politics for social good.
Well, it's good to hear from you, and you were certainly a pioneer in that area, and we thank you for joining us. In fact, I think we have another City Lights author from New York, a name that may be familiar to many of you, Thomas Page McGee. Welcome. You're on. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And you want to talk about how this changed your career when you published a book with City Lights Books?
Sure, yeah. So I wrote a memoir called Man Alive, A True Story of Violence, Forgiveness, and Becoming a Man. And it came out through City Lights partnership with Sister Spit, which is run by Michelle T. And it was just a really amazing thing to be able to write. I mean, basically, they took the book as it was, but my concept was that I wanted to write a book about being a trans man that wasn't telling the typical story about, being born in the wrong body. And it wasn't about a transition narrative, like I started in one place and ended up in another. It's just a story about becoming a person and transitioning from being a young adult to an adult. And City Lights really understood that and got behind the book in a big way. And I think they changed my career because they really supported that vision, which I think was really progressive, and people really responded well to it. So I'm really indebted to them.
Well, we thank you for your call and appreciate your involvement in the program. That's Thomas Page McBee, who is with us from New York. And here's a listener who's with us writing, in the late 90s, when visiting Shakespeare bookstore in Paris, I was tantalized by a white-bearded man sitting on one of the chairs reading books. It was Ferlinghetti. Then in Florence, in the medieval alleys, I was thrilled to see the symbols of City Lights on the walls of bookstores. Imagine the new perspective I had when I came back and looked at City Lights diagonally across from Broadway. Here's a tweet. Lane Katzenberger, let me go to you on this. This is Emily who says, to City Lights, Rad American Women is great. How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, that book, I'm glad that someone asked. I love this book very much. It's our first ever children's book. After 60 years of publishing, we're doing kids' books.
Never thought you'd see that day, did you?
No, honestly, I mean, that was one thing that you could always say is we're eclectic. We publish in many genres, but we don't do kids' books. But this project came to us again through Michelle T. and the Sister Spit imprint, and she brought the authors over, and we looked at this project, and when I saw it, I just knew that this was a City Lights book. It's a beautiful book about...
It's Kate Schatz.
Kate Schatz and Miriam Klein-Stahl is the artist who did the wonderful images in the book. And it's 26 women who named their desires and pursued them against all odds. One of the common thread being that they had to overcome being told that women can't do X, Y, or Z. And it's a very interesting and diverse list of women with different kinds of paths through life and different obstacles besides femaleness that they had to overcome. And it's all about empowerment and pursuing your goals and your dreams and success.
Here's a tweet from a listener named Heather who says, some dot-comers came here hoping to give more people a voice with the internet, similar to Ginsberg himself.
I'm sure that's true.
Well, they do get painted with a broad brush. I mean, even Lawrence.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. They do. And, you know, that's a huge community of people and lots of different entities involved under the umbrella of the word tech. You know, there's huge multinational corporations, and then there's also little startups and, you know, people doing a number of different things. So I think that's true. It's not fair to just paint everyone the same.
Could we also, before we conclude, we did a whole hour on Reddit. I don't know if you got to hear any of that, but, you know, a lot of questions about censorship came up. And certainly, as you said earlier, Lawrence Ferlinghetti testified in the trial of Allen Ginsberg over Howl. We spoke about Lolita to an author in the last segment or the previous segment before you came on the air here. Some thoughts about censorship at this point? We still in a wide open territory as far as you're concerned, defending whatever may... I mean, notwithstanding child pornography and, you know, things that are obvious like that.
No, I mean, I think that we still are doing battle with those forces and constantly, you know. I mean, just to go back to Howl, Howl is frequently censored, not allowed to be read on the radio at certain times of the day. You know, things as simple as that. But I also think that what we're dealing with is a censorship that comes in the form of fear, because when there's this much surveillance of every single thing that you write or say, then people self-censor, and that's something to be afraid of. And we're publishing books about that kind of issue now.
Well, congratulations for the books you have published, the work you've done. And again, Lane Katzenberger is the publisher of City Lights and the executive editor as well. And you can... continue this conversation online, kqed.org/forum, especially if you have memories of City Lights Bookstore or questions you might have. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Tina Larberg and Vinnie Tong. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Senior editor, Dan Zoll, and interns, LaToya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.